Bob Show.
Welcome back to the Bob Show. It's Bob the Beast and Justin.
Greetings. Bob is back.
And so is Justin. I believe I heard Justin barking at the dog just now. Was that you barking back at him?
I was trying to get him to howl.
You were trying to get him to howl.
He doesn't really howl. I was trying to.
He howls at fire engines. Did you try sounding like a fire engine? You have to sound like a fire engine, and then he'll howl for you. And
he's completely bored. He doesn't want to howl.
Well, he's like most dogs. Oh, that, you know, when people are acting like dogs, they, you know, what do they? You know, they don't. They want to. If he wanted a dog, he'd go out and find a dog friend.
He's just baffled.
He is baffled. You know, you want him to howl. Can you do a fire engine?
Maybe if I did a girl dog, he'd be interested.
No, fire engines make him howl. He's cut. He's fixed. You know, girls don't do much more for him than boys do.
I can't do a fire engine.
Well, then he's not going to howl for you. But next time you want to talk to a dog, you know, you ought to figure out what rocks their world.
I could mentally, you know, telepathically communicate with him.
Try it.
You see, he came over to me. He came over and...
Yeah, you could have had a spot on Johnny Carson. You could have replaced Carson. You could have been, you know, the next Letterman. I mean, you could have, it could have been you.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Shoulda what?
It's all behind me now.
It is all behind you. Like everything else is behind us. And day by day, it's getting further behind you.
Indeed. All right, so today we are going to talk about Square Grouper. The 2011 movie, documentary that came out, that was directed by the same folks who brought you another documentary called Cocaine Cowboys. Another movie, a documentary about the drug trade in Miami. Square Grouper deals with the weed trade in Miami in the 70s and 80s. The term square grouper, of course, refers to the bales of marijuana that would get thrown off of boats or little seaplanes and would wash up ashore in Miami.
The little lost bales, and not the ones that, you know, they weren't intentionally tossed there. They were either accidentally dropped, or the guys in the white hats were chasing them.
Yeah, well, there was just seemed to be so much of it around at the time that these things would wash up with some regularity.
Oh yeah, well, there were freighters. You know, like we have freighters parked off of L.A. with, you know, containers backed up from, you know, the Far East, because, you know, they don't have, the labor and the equipment to offload things. Well, they had freighters lined up off of Florida, you know, with weed, not literally, but, you know, figuratively and sometimes literally. I mean, if you think you have supply chain problems, you know, down at, you know, the harbor in Long Beach, or over here in Oakland, you know, imagine what your supply chain problems are when, you know, you're running that kind of operation and a boat doesn't work or a bilge pump blows out or, you know.
In Square Grouper, the kind of the three main players in the documentary are the smuggling gang known as the Black Tuna Gang, which really wasn't much of a gang. It was just, that was just sort of a nickname they gave themselves. And then there was the...
It actually wasn't even a nickname they gave themselves. They gave themselves, apparently, a black gold tuna if they had been successful in some way, shape, or form. You know? And I think the government began calling that, or people that worked with them started calling them that because they had these black tunas.
Okay.
But, you know,
then there was the Ethiopian Zion Coptic Church,
yes,
which was based in the Miami area and dealt weed and consumed a lot of it, and did
I believe have a court case in the federal system trying to prove that they, under religious freedom, they should be entitled to use weed since they used it as a sacrament.
Right.
you know, that was moving through the system when, you know, their weed operation blew up. And
of course, they had no success with that argument.
Probably not, especially since they had a major case to put them all in jail. It's hard to...
Yeah. And then I guess the other major player in the documentary is the little Florida fishing village of Everglades City, which was, I guess, to some extent, kind of a hub for a lot of this activity.
It had been a hub for that kind of activity since they were running slaves into this country. Mm. It had been a hub for that kind of activity since they were running booze in this. Capone used Everglades City. I mean, Everglades City is this dot at the end of, I think, the Ti-Miami Trail, but it might be something else, Crocodile Alley. I mean, there's one road in and one road out, and nothing but Everglades for tens, if not hundreds of miles.
So a convenient port.
Yeah, it's on the
smuggling.
West Coast. Yeah, it's a convenient, you know, where everybody knows each other and is related to each other. So the type of place where, you know, yeah, you can, that sort of thing happens. I mean, it happens along the French and Spanish Alps, and, you know, there's probably a long history of folks that live there whose families have off and on been involved in that game, you know,
yeah,
forever.
And then another place that looms large in the film is the Fontainebleau Hotel,
uh-huh,
which was a hot spot in Miami in the 50s and 60s, all the way through the 70s and 80s, I guess. And in the 70s and 80s, it was very much sort of a headquarters or a place where a lot of the weed trade...
I would say a lot of the weed trade, they set up their headquarters, they set up their base of operations there. We can call it a headquarters, sort of a forward operating post, if you will, you know, and they certainly lived and occupied and were there for a few years and used it as I said, their base of operations in Miami, the command and control center, if you will. But I don't, you know, it was certainly not a, you know, Miami Beach was, South Miami Beach was just a rundown neighborhood with all these cool old deco buildings that eventually became what, you know, rehabbed and gentrified. But it was just old Jews and Cubans, and it was pretty run down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it looked, you know, it was crumbling facades, and, you know, it wasn't particularly, you know, it was just lower income.
Mm-hmm.
And older folks, and Miami Beach itself was no longer the glistening hotspot of, you know, the jet set. It was, you know, it was pretty run down too, and the Fontainebleau had seen better days. And Miami wasn't a go-to place as it is now, especially Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit more, you know, it just wasn't happening anymore like that. The 50s were over. The 60s were even over.
Mm-hmm.
And these grand hotels weren't where, you know, hip people were going.
Mm-hmm. So you crossed paths with some of these characters in your adventures. So
I did.
Let's start with the Black Tuna Gang. Who were the players there, and how did you?
Well, I only knew there were a lot of players there, and you could go see the movie there. I wasn't a member of the Black Tuna Gang,
mm-hmm,
but several of them came from Philadelphia.
Okay.
The two principals came from Philadelphia, one of whom was best friends with my roommate. So that was how I knew him.
And this is Robbie Meisner?
Meister. Who's a really nice guy. He's married. Mm-hmm. He had a couple kids and a few dress shops. You know, the whole government case, I don't know what's going on, and I didn't know Robbie to be a particularly, you know, they were people who's, I think Robbie's parents had clothing stores or were in the clothing business. And certainly Murray, who I knew him through, his father was a furrier, and Murray sold men's clothing. And, you know, they weren't dealers that I knew of or anything. You know, I really don't know, you know, I didn't know Robbie very well. Then he was Murray's friend with, you know, wife named Susan, a couple of little kids. These guys were about 10 years older than me. He was a nice guy. You know, just, you know, regular guy. He wasn't a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
Murray was hardly a hippie. They were, you know.
Who was? Oh, Murray.
Murray's my roommate. And that was how I come to this story.
So then the other guy in Black Tuna was Big Gene.
Well, Big Gene was a guy who the other guy in Black Tuna was a guy named Platshorn.
Platshorn. Okay.
Robbie Platshorn, and I believe him and Robbie Meister were partners, and Platshorn and Meister were pretty much they it was their thing, and they had, I guess, different people from what I've read in, you know, after seeing the movie and realizing, yeah, I do know these guys. Mm. I was there. At least I was there for a day or two with them and had an adventure and a few laughs along the way and, you know, a good story to tell out of it. But I had to read what was there. So, yeah, there was Platshorn and Meister were it. They went down there. They said, I don't know how they fell into the weed trade. Wouldn't have been hard to do. They were businessmen, you know. They got high and partied, and you know, they weren't hippies either of them really. They weren't. I didn't think of them as folks with a political consciousness or a particular social agenda or ethos or anything I would identify as that way. Other than they were decent people, and they weren't, you know, they weren't gangsters or anything. They were just, you know, Platshorn, I believe, was one of these guys that down in Atlantic City was hawking stuff on the boardwalk, stuff like that, sort of auctioneer type of guy. Certainly fast talking and always, you know, looking to turn a buck and whatever. So they had a, now I don't know whether it started as a cover for this, but they had a, used to be able to buy cars at auction, and they had a car auction thing going on there. And one of them must have made a connection at some point, and they started bringing weed in from Colombia, or buying weed from Colombians at first. I'm not sure how the origin myths of the Black Tuna thing, but, you know, it's well documented. Mm-hmm. There's their side, there's the DEA side, mm-hmm. and, you know, you can figure out, you know, somewhere in the middle is probably, you know, fairly accurate accounting of what went on. Certainly they scaled up to the point where, you know, somebody was listening in, watching what they do, and they went down, and poor Robert Platshorn did almost 30 years, and Robert Meister did 20-some years, 25 or so. I think Platshorn did more time than anybody else for a nonviolent pot beef in American jurisprudence. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it was kind of a tragic story, how they got swept up in that.
They were the first ones to really, you know, they changed the business. I mean, they were there for the change, and they were a big part of it, their scale of operations, which was impressive, probably not as impressive as the government made it out to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it was impressive.
How did you come to the Fountain Blue? The Fountain Blue.
I came to the Fountain Blue at the invitation of Robbie Meister, and my roommate Murray Luderman, who also, like I said, wasn't a hippie, but he knew a lot of folks through me, and as a result, he was able to help Robbie. Mm. You know, and I was in Miami, and Murray was there, so I gave him a call. I was in Miami to see a girlfriend who had moved down there and do a little work on my own, this and that. And, you know, I was hoping to pick up some, you know, I was hoping like something would fall in my lap from Murray and Robbie. I wasn't, you know. So anyway, I called Murray up. He said, you know, come over to Fountain Blue. We'll put you up for a couple of days. We got a room here for you. You know, we'll party, you know.
Sounds good.
Robbie wants you to come over. I said, well, it sounds good.
Yeah.
I came over, you know, and I was, you know, hippie kid, you know. It's probably, this was somewhere between 74 and 77. I can't really.
So you got long hair.
I've got long hair.
Long beard.
A long beard.
Bell bottoms.
Bell bottoms, probably for sure. I think bell bottoms are still happening, but certainly jeans.
Yeah.
I rode a motorcycle, so I had a motorcycle.
What kind of bike do you have?
at that time, I probably had a Liverta or a Ducati or both. I don't know which one I didn't have a bike with me there.
So you're easy rider. You pull up.
No,
your,
I wasn't an easy rider. I was more of a cafe racer type of guy. You know, I had Ducatis and Livertas and Moto Guzzis. I had a Norton. I had a Triumph. I did have a BMW one, but or one of them. But you know, so they were sort of quicker moving. Uh-huh. You know, I wasn't, didn't have ape hangers and shit like that, clip-ons, and, sort of like, by cafe racing, I meant, from that time, cafe to cafe, and uh-huh. person who got there last bought the drinks, so I tried not to be last.
So you show up at the Fontainebleau, the hippie kid on the motorcycle,
the
and you stick
and
out a little bit.
I do.
This is kind of like a an older person's hotel, right?
Yeah, this is like people, women with hair that's been dyed enough that it's turned blue, and mm-hmm. it's certainly not, it's.
So what are these? What's Meinster and what's the other guy's name?
Platschorn.
Your friend, your roommate.
Oh, Murray.
Murray, what are they doing there?
Well, they're waiting for a load of weed to come in. And, they're, what are they doing? They're snorting coke and they're playing and partying and smoking and, doing the occasional hooker or country western star that comes through there. There's entertainment down in the lounge. So, it's a party.
So they're just partying there, waiting for a load of weed to come in.
Well, Robbie isn't partying there. He's got a family back there in Miami somewhere. So Robbie wasn't partying, but Murray certainly was partying. And there was other cast of characters whose names I don't recall, the either people they were working with or whatever. So they had a bunch of suites and rooms, like on the top floor of the Fontainebleau, like a bunch.
The presidential suite.
They had the presidential suite, which, some of it I'm a little confused about. I thought the other side was like the Waldorf Astoria in New York, was one side was like condos and one side was, or co-op, and one side was
hotel.
And if you haven't been there, don't know, the Fontainebleau is a huge hotel. It's several thousand people, I think, can stay there. I mean, it's huge. Mm. It's massive. And one reason they were at the Fontainebleau, two reasons. One, they had a guy who had a restaurant downstairs. I think he was Cuban. He might have been Colombian. Little skinny guy who will feature in this story that you want me to tell. somebody's family might have owned the place or something. I can't remember. I have to remember what I read in looking this up, knowing we might talk about it. But there is this Cuban guy, and the restaurant was named after him. You can probably poke and see in there. And through him, they had at that time, a hotel had a switchboard.
Yep.
And they had guys parking the car and everything. And of course, the first thing I noticed there was how wild this scene was, and it seemed to me from my own experience that they were, this was a fairly loose operation that was going down. I had seen friends of mine in Philadelphia have problems. I said, they have to be watching you. The feds are on to it. In fact, I think I see feds around here. We have it all wired. I thought, I think they do too, but, I'm not sure. And we do this. And they whisked me through the kitchen. I thought, wow, this is a Bobby Kennedy moment here. I hope not, but, they're whisking through the kitchen. So they clearly had it wired, and they took me upstairs, and they said, we have to do something about you. And I said, well, you have to do something about you. He said, well, you can't look like this. look at you. have you noticed that? I said, yeah, they all look like they're on the golf course, like the pink and the plaids and, white, a lot of white and everything.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you have to fit in here. So go down to the men's store and get some clothes.
Okay.
It's on us, and that was a real hint that like, wow, this is going to be a full ride. This is a scholarship. I must have did good. They must, they're doing good. And
it sounds they were swimming in cash.
They were swimming in cash. And because my roommate, my roommate was able to point them in the right direction because he knew who all my friends were, that it helped them enormously. So they were showing some gratitude, showing me some love. I was like, all right. So I went down and I told them that, you know, they tried to get me to get a haircut. I was like, it was like, no, that's a deal breaker, pal. You can keep your coke, keep your hookers, whatever. I'm not cutting my fucking hair for you. So, you know, they said, okay, well, you know, I don't know whether to maybe get it styled, who knows, trim the beard. Now, I might not have done anything for him. I just like, no, that's it. But I did go down to the men's store, you know, and I bought, you know, Italian knits. You know, I bought all this crazy stuff. It was like, you know, it's like, okay, Frank Sinatra meets Desi Arnaz. I think I can do this, you know. Do I want to go Desi with this? Do I want to go Frank with this? All right, you know. And I got all kinds of cool stuff.
You got pimped out.
I've got pimped out, and, you know, and I got some pink because I'm in Miami, you know, and sure. Plaid, and yeah.
Did you get the, like, the Ricky Ricardo, you know, pants with the satin stripe down, you know, like the tuxedo pants, that kind of thing?
I didn't get a tuxedo, but I did get Ricky Ricardo pants that looked like something Ricky would be wearing. There might have, I don't think there is any with a stripe, but
any brocade or velvet figure into this?
No, this is like, it's hot there. This is Miami.
Okay.
So
you're a sucker.
I might have got a, no.
But you were going Italian.
I was going Italian, so I got some Italian knit type of stuff. Okay. Lightweight, you know, instead of
you look like a mafia dude.
Well, no, I didn't. You know, they didn't know what to make.
A mafia hippie. You were just confusing people. You
know? I was. Well, I had a sense of fashion. I knew, you know, I had a sense of fashion. So I put it together in a unique way for them, and they were wildly amused.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Did you get some cool shoes?
Yeah, of course.
Some Italian shoes?
Yeah. I got some white shoes, and I got some blue suede shoes. I mean, what else would you do? And I had, like, I liked plaid pants, and I liked houndstooth and stuff like that.
Okay.
So I got a lot of plaid, a lot of houndstooth, a straw hat, you know, some nice shirts that, you know, weren't, you know, sort of the Cuban type of thing that, you know, with a couple buttons. I got some of those. And
Well, now you mentioned that
Italian knits, of course. How can you not have Italian knits? I might have got some shark skin.
Any brand names you want to drop?
No, because I wouldn't remember any brand names. But it was, you know, it's like
Ferragamo.
I don't think
Gucci.
So. I don't think so. No, it wasn't. I don't know if they even existed then. How would I fucking know? But anything, like, you could go up to the Fairmont here and look at their store, and, you know, so it's not that cool and hip, and it wasn't. But it was, you know, good quality stuff.
So you mentioned that the switchboard there.
Yeah.
They would basically relay messages for these guys. Like, these guys would be doing weed deals on through the hotel
they
switchboard.
Doing, I don't know what they were doing as far as that, but the switchboard was able to monitor any traffic going in and out. And I think their concern was more with, as a surveillance means and what was going on in the hotel in case, you know. I guess in case there were agents there, or that nobody be listening in on their calls.
So did these guys use the hotel phones and switchboard to?
Yeah, this is a little
business?
Bit before. Apparently so. I mean, I don't know if they did business, but certainly to arrange. You know, you had to talk to people. You didn't have a cell phone. If there were mobile phones in '77, they would have been these big shoebox size things that. You know, very few people had a short shelf life.
Didn't they, at one point, I think I remember in the movie that they had some sort of antenna set up on the top of the hotel
that
allowed them to do...
Yeah, that gets to this. So I get that. Yeah, so we're all up right, on the 17th floor.
All right, so,
that's, yeah, they,
so they're taking you up to the suites.
They took me up to my side, and they gave me a room. I didn't get a suite. I wasn't, you know... But they gave me a room. They gave me a tray full of, you know... party favors, and they sent up some girls. I mean, like something I never experienced
before. They just
before.
Delivered them to you.
Yeah, no, girls showed up at door high.
Oh.
You know, multiple girls. Yeah.
How'd they look?
Beautiful. They were beautiful, you know, 20-something.
White girls?
Yeah, mostly white.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly white. And occasionally a Latino girl, but, you know, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it was nice. It was, like, nice. I was there for, you know, I can't remember, 4 or 5 days or... You know, days, maybe a week, up to a week, you know, off and on. I don't know if I was there all the time. I mean, why leave? You go down to the pool, drinks, you can do any. You own the place.
Mm.
You know, everybody in the hotel, you know, from the doorman to everybody, they were wired up there. No, they had, so on the other side, they had this gigantic duplex. It wasn't even a suite. It was a duplex. I remember there was a spiral stair in there and everything. And from there, they had put, they had antennas on the roof, and their antenna actually was higher than whatever the Coast Guard had or the Navy had. Like they were, because the building was the tallest building on the beach.
Uh-huh.
And they had an antenna on top of the building so that they could communicate with airplanes and boats that were out at sea. And they, you know, they, and they didn't, I mean, I went up there because that was where they were staying, or like Platch. I don't know who was staying there, but, you know, occasionally I would go over there, be invited over, come over, have a drink, play pool. There was a big pool table there, I remember, I think. And, you know, it's just an amazing thing. They had this long table in there, like a conference-type table. You know, something you'd see, like, the king and queen sitting at one end and the other, you know, where you imagine, like, say, Putin's at one end and, the, you know, at the other end, you talk to people.
This is where they would have meetings and stuff?
They would. So, you know, I was there for several days. I stayed. Murray and I were up there, and we were having a good old time. I remember meeting Barbara Mandrell, was that?
Oh, yeah.
And her sisters.
Mm-hmm.
They were all
the Mandrells, yeah.
The Mandrell sisters.
They were a country act, right?
Yeah, they were playing there.
Okay.
So I think Murray actually was with Barbara Mandrell for a part of it. I think she joined the party. She wasn't one of the girls that came knocking at my door, but, you know. So that probably, you could probably figure out when they were there. And that would probably date when I was around there, if that information is there anywhere. Give me a sense of what year it was. So I went up there, and that was it. And, you know, a good time was had. But I did see what I thought were, what I thought were government agents running around. You know, so I was a little bit more. Yeah, I tried to be as cautious as I could and have a good time. They weren't there for me, and I wasn't doing anything there. I wasn't involved in their caper in any way, shape, or form.
You thought you saw government agents?
Oh, yeah.
Where, in the lobby, or?
It was really more out in the parking, you know, when I would come in and out, that I thought I saw folks, especially the first time I pulled up. I was like, you know, this looks like the heat, you know? And I had grown up in South Philly, and I certainly was familiar enough with, you know, surveillance of, you know, figures that were worthy of that sort of surveillance. And I thought they were under surveillance. I told them. And they said, yeah, we know. And I thought, well, what are you doing here if you know? And it was sort of, well, we think we're smarter than them. And I thought, well, you're not smarter than them because they're onto you. So if you were so smart, they wouldn't be outside, would they?
But back up in the suite.
Here. So back in the suite. So I'm there for days, and they finally get whatever they're waiting for, I guess, because, you know, I finally get the promise of a little something for myself. You know, back in, you know, they get out of the blue. They said, you know, we're gonna hook you up. When you get home, there'll be something there for you. Oh, great. That's great. Come up and have breakfast. I thought, yeah, sounds good. Eggs Benedict, you know, and up there, they told me it was Sinatra's apartment or something. Who knows? And up there, there was a bunch of these guys who's, when I look at the indictment, I can remember some of their names and some of their stories. You know, I can remember some of them as players. I mean, I can read what they were accused of and say, yeah, that was the guy that did their security. No, I don't remember there being, you know, I don't remember some of what I saw in the movie being as the government portrayed it. You know, I think it was not as heavy-handed, though they did have a guy doing security, and they did have a problem of some sort, you know, a dispute. Some kind of hijacking of their goods. You know, like there was Cubans and Colombians involved. I can't remember. And they had it stashed somewhere. And, you know, something went wrong. And somebody grabbed their goods and moved it somewhere else. And, you know, there some kind of money dispute. I'm not sure what it was. Wasn't, you know, but I knew there'd been like a big brouhaha. And,
And you saw the, you saw this dispute happen in the suite?
Well, I saw, I was there. By the time I became aware of any of this, the dispute had been resolved. They had gotten their goods back. They had made nice with whoever, you know, had taken the goods and or whatever sort of arrangements they were making for distribution, which had something to do with that.
Okay.
And something to do with, you know, probably how they got it in and who was owed what, you know, or who did what. Yeah, nothing that I ever really was clear on, other than, you know, it was a big brouhaha and they had to do some serious threatening with, you know, I was told with a helicopter hovering over somebody's house that we're saying, if, you know, we will, yeah, we'll drop this tank of gasoline on your house if you don't give us back our goods. I think it was something like that I was told, but I don't know whether that was true or not.
Okay.
You know? But I do believe that they got a helicopter and probably made an impression with the helicopter. Who knows whether they threatened to drop something and how they would do that in some area like that. But that you could get a helicopter and come by and let them know how crazy you are, I guess, right? That's possible.
Yeah.
That made sense to me. Anyway, I went there for this breakfast and they have this long table. Now it's full of all these people that are there to celebrate their success.
Mm-hmm.
Not only have they gotten it in, but they've got it back or whatever. And, you know, I'm kind of ready to leave anyway. I've had enough fun and I'm grateful that, you know, I haven't gotten caught up in their madness. And there's a guy sitting at the table named, I think his name was Gene. And anyway, had two bluebirds tattooed on his pecs, you know.
What does that signify?
I don't know what it signified, but I always thought of him as, you know, that's how I always remembered him.
Okay.
And this was when people didn't have a lot of tattoos. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like, oh, it's interesting. He was a big man, I remember. I'd met him before, and, you know, I shot pool with these guys. We'd done what, you know.
What was Gene's role in the outfit?
I'm not sure. I didn't know at the time. I've read that he had... He was part of the off, you know, loading. He had some ins and outs in different ports,
okay,
up north in Florida and at an airport near Miami, maybe, where he knew folks. And I think he might have had some fishing boats up north. And, you know, he was in the, I think, he had a piece of the action and some connections to their puzzle and putting it all together.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting there, and he was, I thought, a pretty fairly funny guy, you know, wry sense of humor. And I got off the elevator went right, you know, they had its own elevator, this penthouse.
Uh-huh.
So it had its own elevator, and you open up and there's the stairs and the bed. It's pretty impressive. Certainly for me, I don't think I'd ever seen any kind of, you know, condo or apartment or anything that was like, well,
you're just a wide-eyed kid from Philadelphia.
I didn't say wide-eyed kid. I mean, you know, but, you know, I certainly wasn't, you know, from the penthouses of New York. And a table's full of people. There's nowhere for me to sit. And I said, well, you know, he said, sit down. I said, well, where am I going to sit? There's nowhere for me to sit. And he said, I'll make room for you. And he grabbed the guy from the restaurant who was sitting next to him and lifted him out of the chair, telling him what, you know, cocksucking this and that, and you did this and you did that, you betrayed us, and you know, and you're going to tell me what happened. He's begging, please. He's like, you know, and he started screaming, this one was fucking his wife, and that one was doing that, and that's why he told the Cubans this, or the Colombians, or whatever, and that's why they grabbed the weed and hijacked your stuff. And meanwhile, he took the guy, while the guy is screaming and yelling, out to the balcony.
Yeah.
And he hung him by his heels, and we're like 17 floors up. And this is to get the more information. Said, you are either going to shorten up or learn to fly.
Shorten up?
Shorten up or learn to fly. In other words, you drop, you get squashed. You're going to be very short, you know? Or, you know, you're going to, I don't even know what it meant, but it was like a hell, it stuck with me all these years. Like, okay, shorten up. I knew the learn to fly part. Like, okay, he's hanging by, screaming, yelling, pissing his pants, everything. I mean, terrifying. The guy was a big man. He was a little man. And that's when he That might be when he started screaming about my wife, and this, I can't remember which one, you know, probably the head of security, I don't know, anyway, somebody, or maybe it was Gene, or who knows, you know, he wasn't just, you know, fucking his wife, he was fucking her in many unique positions and ways and orifices and everything else, apparently, you know, it wasn't just a simple missionary thing.
So this was like,
full description.
So this was like something personal between Gene and...
I don't think it was somebody there. It was somebody, you know, further up the feeding chain was messing with his wife while he's down in the kitchen doing all the, you know, he's the inn at the Fontainebleau.
Yeah.
His family owned the restaurant and maybe he was a serious inn there at the Fontainebleau. He's what gave them the access there. Whether he had other parts in their operation or not, I have no idea. I mean, I'd have to read the indictment and try and figure out who's who.
Yeah.
Some of it I recognize from the picture there. It's like, oh, there he is, and oh, that's the one there. There's not much about Gene in there. So they did yank him back in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they yanked him back in, and he was a mess, and they got the truth out of him. And then there's yelling at Gene and Bob, and they're all yelling at different people there for, you know, causing this near disaster, and you know, because they, somebody been messing with this guy's wife, you know.
You know. Gene's wife.
No, no. Oh. The Cuban guy from the restaurant.
Oh.
The little guy who was hung by his heels, not Gene. I don't know, you know, I don't think anybody would mess with Gene's wife, you know. He's not, you know, so this guy was sort of like their, they treated him, you know, as their sort of, what's the word, you know, that, you know, they were condescending to him. You
okay.
Know? You know, they were, you know, very respectful, and they treated him like a joke. And meanwhile, he was a key part of their success. Gave him full access to this hotel that had a lot of facilities that they were able to use to do their thing. So, yeah, yanked him back in. And, you know, they sent him off down the elevator to clean himself up with somebody. And he was a wreck. Imagine being hung by your heels, you know. You know, and having to confess and, you know, the whole thing. You probably, you know, God knows when they went to court what it was like with this guy. You know, I'll never forget it. So anyway, they come back and, you know, and I'm just sort of standing there just, you know, a mouth agape. I was like, whoa, what the fuck? I just see, you know, what am I doing here? And Gene, you know, picks up the chair that's been knocked over and puts it there. He said, I made a place for you. I said, you know, I said, come over. I said, Gene, I said, I appreciate you making a place for me. But, you know, I think I'm going to take your place at the table. And I pulled his chair out and I sat down. I said, you know. Yeah, I did. I pulled that. Something like that. You know, I did take his chair. I said, you know, that, you know, I feel it's only right that, you know, I'd not be put in that position there again where, you know, I saw what happened to the last guy. Why don't you take those eggs? I'll take these, you know. I'm not going to have them tested for poison or anything. God knows what you... And so it was, the whole room was laughing that, like, he got, you know, he, it was the funniest thing, you know. So anyway... It
broke the tension.
It broke the tension, which was kind of, you know, and I had my breakfast and, you know, went back, and when I got back to Philly, they took care of me, and I made a few shekels, and that's that story.
So the Cuban guy, or was his name Jimenez?
It might have been Jimenez, but did he own the restaurant? This guy was the restaurant. I saw that name in the indictment, but there was a restaurant named after him there.
Okay.
And I'm not sure whether that's the guy or not, but it could have been. At times it sounded like him.
Yeah, the government indictment, you know, and this is the indictment in the case against Robbie Meinster and Platshorn and Gene. And, yeah, it says that Meinster moved to Miami in early 77. Is that about right?
It could have been early. So, I mean, I came out here in 77 for the, and moved out here. I did go back and forth a bit, and I was in Hawaii. I thought it was earlier in 77, but I read that too, and it could have been 77. They were down there as early as 74. Whether Robbie lived there or not, I don't know.
Well, so it says the Enterprise at that time in 77 owned several yacht-sized vessels and operated out of several locations, including a suite in the Fontainebleau Hotel.
Well, there's a, if you back up further, there's years when they were at the Fontainebleau. They were there for a year and a half.
Okay.
So whether that was the end of their time there or the beginning of their time there, hard for me to tell.
I don't think that this Jimenez, who they mention in here, is the restaurant guy.
I don't think so.
Because what he was involved in was the auction business that they had, which is how they got their boats. I think, right?
It was how they covered a lot of their action. They got their boats from a guy whose father was in the, he was a broker, boat broker.
Okay.
That's where they got the boats from. That's another guy in there. One of whom, you know, of course, who rolls over on them and all this other stuff. But as I recall, that's where that guy came from. I believe Gene had ins and outs in the ports and the airports.
Mm-hmm.
And also transportation stuff. I mean, they had a huge transportation thing. When I believe when I knew them was earlier than some of this stuff, because I think they were just getting on a roll, and all these problems seemed to explode on them. And said, but maybe that's why I was seeing people all around. Like, you know, you got.
Jimenez. He actually wound up. Becoming a government witness against
them.
It
could be.
Raymond Jimenez, Platschorn hired him in 76 as comptroller for the auction.
See, this guy had the...
He was... so he would have been like their accountant. The auction business... What they did there, this was in 1976. Platschorn leased property in Miami, in order to operate an auto auction business, which you mentioned earlier. And the auction apparently was intended to be a cover for their pot business, importation and distribution with Meinster. The auction business apparently lost money, and another guy who figures in this is a podiatrist named Morris Keller, who was the truck driver on occasion for some of the gang's pot shipments.
And that was early on, though, right?
That was in 74.
Right. See, my sense is that I don't remember him, but I do remember they got a bunch up there at some point because you remember, I'm going to need a minute here, you remember CJ?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first time I think they did it, they wound up going to CJ's house and leaving... Like if it says a couple thousand in his living room or something, like outside. And I think that house got raided, you know.
In Philadelphia?
Yeah, outside of Philly somewhere.
Okay.
And there was 2,000 or 4,000 pounds. I don't think anybody got caught in the raid. They lost a bunch.
Okay.
As I recall, I mean, I'd have to ask somebody else who might remember, and there's not a lot of people that would remember that I could ask. But I do remember that.
Okay.
I remember that. And that might have been when I became aware that, I should have some of this. Yeah.
So the indictment says that in 77, Jimenez, the comptroller for the auction business, went to the Fontainebleau suite to deliver a car to Myers, and upon entering the suite, Jimenez saw Platschorn, Meinster, Myers, who was Big Gene, and other Black Tuna members large stacks of money covered a table.
They have a lot of money, yeah.
After asking Jimenez whether he had ever seen so much money, Myers remarked that it is not all ours yet, so don't worry about it.
What does that mean, don't worry about it?
Well, he's the comptroller, so he probably has to keep track of it.
Yeah.
The Black Tuna members apparently did not hesitate to fully avail themselves of the Fontainebleau's room service. Jimenez testified that Platschorn told him that the room service bill from October 1976 to April 1977 was $66,000. So these guys were living like gangsters.
They were. But they weren't gangsters.
Right.
They were just like, you know, they weren't gangsters. They also weren't hippies. You know?
They sort of just stumbled into this.
There's in these stories of them, and Platschorn has a book. He has a book. So, you know, they were high-rolling guys, I mean, at that point, but they were...
They're coming
my
for
impression,
us.
My impression, they're coming for us. They can.
There he goes. Finally, we get a howl out of the beast.
Well, that's a fire engine. Now, when you can howl like a fire engine, he will respond.
All right, I got to try again. Beast.
That doesn't sound like a fire engine. Look, he's
just did nothing. Just
nothing.
Ignores that.
No. He only does it for a fire engine.
Ah.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I always wanted a dog that would howl at fire engines, you know. So grateful that's the only siren he howls at. It could have been even more. So, yeah. So what were we asking there? Where were we with this before the dog stole the show? At least he isn't eating the cable. I brought his bed down here. I gave him a bunch of bones.
Yeah.
You know, he likes to show off for Justin.
He gets bored, and then he just and he doesn't like it that we're not giving him attention. And
that's right.
He chews through the cable to stop the podcast.
Yeah, I can't blame him.
So, yeah, we were talking about...
trying to figure out who the guy that was hanging out the window was. He certainly wasn't the comptroller. This guy had a restaurant to run.
Right, yeah.
He was the manager of the restaurant. It was named after him. I think his family owned it, or mm-hmm. I don't know what the deal was with that. He was central to the smooth running of their operation, though, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, was always played sort of, you know, made real nice with these guys. None of whom, you know, I mean, I don't know. I know that Platschorn and Meinster certainly were not gangsters of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
I found that some of the stuff that they were saying about him probably wasn't, it was exaggerated. Probably some of the stuff they said about themselves was exaggerated. Who knows? They did bring in a lot of weed, though. You know, more than most people did back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Though there certainly were other people doing what they were doing. They were okay. I mean, they were, you know, they were, yeah. I mean, it's Miami. So, I don't know if I can give you any more about that.
I think that's kind of the end of that particular anecdote.
It's an anecdote, but I can go on to, if you want, the Coptic Church. I also knew those guys.
Oh, you did? How'd you know them?
Well, a lot of these folks came from Philly. You know, they were Jewish guys, a lot of them from Philly. And I knew one in particular. I keep thinking his name was Bobby Cohen, but it could have been something else. I never was at that house in Miami, but I did go to Jamaica to, you know, the mothership, so to speak. They had a big at least hundreds of acres out down by Morant Bay or somewhere on the Kingston end of the island.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the eastern end of the island, up in the mountains there. And they had a big church that they built there, a big building. I believe I saw Toots and the Maytels there. I mean, it was there, you know, they were very religious, very conservative, orthodox, what you think of as semi-fundamentalist about their religious beliefs. And they were Coptic Christians, and they believed that weed was a living sacrament. And they practiced that along with smuggling many tons of it into the country. And, you know, so I knew them from getting weed off them up in Philly, same as I knew, you know, same thing was me. I was a hippie. I also believed it was a sacrament. I spent years in Jamaica smoking a chalice and still do think of it as something that elevates one's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to, you know, now all of the cures it has for everything that ails you, I still don't use it medicinally or think of it medicinally, though it works medicinally. Indians have been using weed for thousands of years medicinally. Not American Indians, but Indians from India. It's part of Ayurvedic medicine and the herbal culture of India, which is where South Asia, where the weed culture really comes from. At least its longest continuous use as both a medicinal herb and as a something you'd use in a spirit quest while chanting and meditating.
Mm-hmm.
Once went to this site in Pashpandan in Nepal. It's, I think, the second largest Hindu complex, you know, in the world. I think it's second to India, and it's the stream that eventually goes into the Ganges and is a stop, was a stop for Buddha, and certainly a stop for Krishna, because they have a site in there. And you have all these sadhus that are parts of different sects. And it's also a spot where they would, you know, if you were to die and you were a Hindu and you were to be cremated, this, you would want to be cremated at this river because it goes into the Ganges.
Mm.
It's one of the major rivers. I can't remember what it is. And Pashpadnan is this. So to get into the complex, you could cross this bridge. It's positively was something out of the Middle Ages, where, you know, people, they sold houses on the bridge, you know, like little shops and, you know, small houses, and people lived on the bridge and had little businesses that supported the pilgrims coming there. And there was a temple with a bull, and you weren't allowed in the temple unless you were a Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
But you're allowed in the rest of the complex, and there would be monks living in cells all over the place, little caves carved into the river, the little cliffs that came off from the riverbank on that side. And then within the compound, or within the acreage that was there, I don't know why I'm calling it a compound, there are different sects that practiced different disciplines of Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
of Hinduism. This is all Hindus, among which was a sect that was devoted to Krishna, that kept a campfire that they claimed that, you know, was where Krishna camped about 5,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's a you know, it wasn't a camp, you know, it was inside a building. It was just a small fire that they kept going. And if it hadn't been going for 5,000 years, I would venture to say it's probably been going for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's like the Olympic torch. Can't let it go out.
Can't let it go out. And the reason you can't let it go out is that these were hash babas.
What?
Yeah, these were hash babas. In other words, they used hash in their prayers,
in
their meditations, in their chanting.
Okay.
And they had to keep the fire going because that's how they lit the chillum. They would take an ember from the fire, put it on top of the chillum, and you would fire away.
Uh-huh.
And you would bring them your best hash. You would make shit special just to bring to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Nepal, you hand roll. You know, it's hand rubbed, as opposed to Afghanistan, which is dried pot and shaken. This is a resin pot where you just go out and, you know, you take the pot plant and you roll the buds between your hands, and you roll enough buds until you got enough black goop on your hands to scrape it off, and that's how you make hash. So they would use leather gloves and scrape it off the gloves, and, you know, they had other equipment.
That must take forever to get just a small amount.
Yeah, it does take forever to get what they called a tola, which was about 9 or 10 grams. And that's about as much as you could, sticky stuff as you could gather up if you were good at it, you know, without, you know, that's, and then you'd have to do more. And for, you know, your average white guy, that took quite a while. I mean, they were a little bit more proficient at it. You know? And it was everywhere. And it was sort of shocking. If you, and they don't smoke weed. Nobody in Asia smokes weed. I mean, nobody in South Asia. They do in Southeast Asia. But they, and, you know, you have to be careful doing it, because if you get too much leaf matter in there, it, the leaf matter will, you know, you can't dry it properly because that starts to rot, and it, you know, can, you know, so you have to be careful, and you can't pick the stuff out. I mean, it's a pretty dense goo. Mm-hmm. And you let it set up for some days. It's not that great when you first do it. You want to let it sort of set up and harden a bit. It's not hardened, but just, I don't know, it's just, it's too, it doesn't smoke very well when you first do it. A couple of days later, it's fine. But, you know, if you can leave it for a week or so, that's kind of best. As I recall, it could be different. Days, I mean, the timing of all this, that's sort of what I recall. But it mm-hmm. could be a little different. And,
yeah. You know. So, so that's sort of the origin in Southeast Asia or Southern Asia.
South Asia, yeah.
In the Hindu tradition,
right.
But Coptic Christianity
is different. And in Rossi, so I the end of the story, so I did go there and they did do it, and I swear either I levitated or they levitated, or this shit was so good that, like, I, you know, they started to chant and this whole thing, and they're, and it's, you know, it was one of the more profound I would say religious experience, but mystical experiences I've had. Yeah. Uh-oh.
Oh, he's getting bored. Are he wants you, some attention.
You want some attention?
He wants some a mystical union.
You know what he really wants?
Krishna.
He wants his dinner.
Oh, he's getting hungry, huh?
It's 6:30.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's 6:30, and I'm ready for my dinner. So we'll wrap this part of it up soon. So we'll segue right back to the Coptics, and we can do this either after dinner or another time.
We can do a part two.
We can do a part two on the Coptic church, because they go down, and they were interesting. And, you know, it's like dealing with any fundamentalist sect. But they aren't Rastas. They have to, some of them might have had dreadlocks. But, you know, the Rastafarianism is not Coptic church.
It's different.
Yeah, they are very Ethiopian-oriented, as is the Coptic Church, but they're oriented towards Rastafari, which is Haile Selassie. They do read the Old Testament, King James Version mostly, and mostly Psalms and Ecclesiastics and things like that, but they do use the Bible in their rituals with pot, certainly.
The Coptics or the Rastafarians?
Both of them did.
Yeah.
Both of them would quote biblical passages while smoking the herbs. But we're going to have to call for now, because when he's done with the bones, he's going to come after our arms and legs. You know,
we might be dinner.
We could be dinner.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So we say good night for now.
Good night, and see you for part two.
Yeah. All ciao. Right.